Last Word on Today FM.
Now, joining us for the Culture Club today is Amanda Coogan. And Amanda is a performance artist. And she is about to present what's called a 7-day durational performance at the Cork Centre for Architectural Education. It's called Caught in the Furze. So Amanda, explain to me what's involved in that, please, as a performance artist.
I know, a performance art is this great mixture art form. So you might call it live art or performance art, and it's somewhere in between theatre and the visual arts. So I'm making an exhibition, and what I call it is a live exhibition. So I'll be there performing every day for 5 hours a day. And really, it's about an exhibition as we know it. There might be paintings on the wall or sculptures on the floor, but with this exhibition, the live exhibition, these things will move and change. And so me, in this case, is like a living sculpture, except that I am a human being and I'll walk around, I'll change the installation all the time. So for this Caught in the Furze, I'm completely crazy about furze bushes. I'm in the midst of a complete obsession. And you know, furze bushes, gorse bushes, these wild, scraggly things that we see lining the motorways up and down the country. And in April, they go into this incredible kind of yellow. And now they're kind of browny green. And so I'm hanging some of them like sculptures in the exhibition. And I can only say now, a week and a half out, Matt, I'll be playing with them. What that entails, who knows? Because when I'm doing durational performances, it's very much a kind of following the present moment. In other words, improvising or riffing. My lovely husband calls it free jazz, Coogan. So when I'm just going with the flow in a kind of a John Coltrane or Miles Davis kind of way and improvising off a theme.
And will people just drop in and out and watch you for a while and head off again, maybe come back again later that day or the following day?
Yeah, because it is an exhibition in flux, so it'll constantly change and shift. What I would advocate is, well, of course, it's a visual art space, so we take that vocabulary. You can come in and leave as you like. Spend 5 minutes with me, spend 2 hours with me, 5 hours. And what I'd say is day one will be different to day two and radically different to day seven. I'm known for being night and day from the beginning of a piece, the middle of a piece and the end of a piece. And it's really interesting because this is part of Midsummer Festival with the Glucksmann. The Glucksmann Gallery, of course, is part of UCC. And actually, we're engaging with the creative writing master's students in UCC. And they're going to drop into me 3 times every single day and note or document how it's going. So they'll be the kind of eyewitness account of the shift and the change. And they'll be communicating that on social. Now I go on social media. I'm not too sure.
How'd you get into this? Are there many people doing this type of performative art in Ireland?
Yeah, well, it is a kind of newish, I would say, 100 years old. Like if we think of theatre or we think of the visual arts like sculpture and painting, they are so ancient and so old. And about 100 years ago, they started playing in the visual arts with liveness or the body or performance. Or we even think of Ballet Russe, which had this incredible conglomeration of, you know, Stravinsky, Marc Chagall, the choreography and making these uber pieces of work, you know. And so I studied here in Dublin with some amazing performance artists, Alan O'Kelly and Pauline Cummins, Irish performance artists. And I looked all over the world, actually. Well, it was more like Europe. And I found an artist called Marina Abramović. And she is kind of, well, she calls herself the godmother of performance art. Very famous, an art star. And I studied with her for 2 years. about 25 years ago. I'm not a spring chicken. And I've kind of been working with her ever since. She keeps calling me and going, oh, the baby, can you do this for me or can you do that for me? So I still have a wonderful relationship with her. She is like my art mum in that way.
Okay. I wish this is radio, so obviously people can't see you. So you're probably, your use of hands, you're the most expressionful person that I've seen in here. And of course, I think there's a reason for that, isn't there? Because you're also a sign language interpreter and you grew up with parents who are deaf.
Yeah, I should try and sit on my hands. This is
not at all, not at all.
Yes, I am blessed, I have to say, by being the child of deaf parents. They call us CODAs, children of deaf adults, is kind of the international term for people like me. And my parents spoke in sign language, so my family home was a visual manual household. So you went inside my house and we all signed and then we ran out on the street and we chatted. And
is it your first language, sign language?
My mother tongue, yeah. Yeah.
You're not that you're short of a word in the English language.
Yeah, I, you know, when I was born, I'm the first born. I have a lovely baby sister and baby brother. My parents were recommended that they would get a radio for the fear in those days that I wouldn't be able to learn to speak. I wouldn't, which is, we now know is absolute rubbish. But they were all, they were told and they were bought a big radio. And now think of the old 1970s radio with the big knobs on the top. And every morning, dutifully, Mum turned on that radio, which actually was just, was out of tune, I now know, but was just a kind of box that made noise sitting on the end of the kitchen table. And then one day, I must have been about 8 or 9, a babysitter came in during the summer because my mum was working in the mornings, and she literally, her finger just rolled across those big knobs. And all of a sudden, music, sound that was understandable came out of this box. And myself and my baby sister were electrified that this thing could actually make sound.
Was that your introduction to music?
I think so, because of course, when I was growing up, there was no music in the house. I didn't have a mum and dad passing me on great musical tomes or playing me things at all. So I think it was. I have very vague memories of when.
Can you remember your first single, so that you bought?
Oh, absolutely. I think from when that babysitter, and God help her, I can't remember her name, flicked that button and I went, oh my goodness, pop. And she changed it to pop music. She must have been 14 or 15 looking after us through the summer. Changed it to pop music. And I remember going, oh my goodness. And then linking in with these Saturday morning TV programs like Tis Was or Saturday, I can't even remember the names of them. And they had all these fabulous people like Toya Wilcox and the Police. And I just fell in love with Blondie. I thought she was the greatest thing. I had blonde hair, so I was like,
I still have.
I want to be like her. So I think that my first single was Call Me. Blondie's Call Me, which I just loved.
Let's hear a little bit of it. Debbie Harry and Blondie, Call Me, the first choice on the of the Culture Club of Amanda Coogan. So let's go to favourite album. And you've gone from one from the mid-80s or so, The Waterboys, This Is the Sea. Why have you picked that one?
Absolutely. I mean, we used to go to Wexford all the time as children. My mum's from Wexford and I still go to Wexford down by the sea. And The Waterboys, when I was a teenager, were just the greatest thing. From This Is the Sea to The Hole of the Moon. They're just so evocative, so gorgeously Irish as a band. I just adore them.
Let's hear a little bit of This Is the Sea.
These things you keep, you better throw them away. You want to turn your back on your soulless days. Once you were a tethered, and now you are free. Once you were a tethered, and now you are free. That was the river. This is the sea. And now if you're feeling weary, if you've been alone too long, or maybe you've been suffering from a few too many plans that have gone wrong, and you're trying to remember how fine your life used to be.
The Waterboys, This Is the Sea. And you also have a choice, Amanda, again from the 1980s, The Cure, Boys Don't Cry. Why have you picked that one out?
Isn't it terrible? You keep referring your whole life to the albums that you listened to as a teenager. And I was what we used to call a Cure head, or a wannabe Cure head. I think that's a special word for here. I think they were called goths over in England. My cousin was a goth. I was a Cure head. And I had blonde hair as a child, and I wasn't allowed to dye my hair black. It was a devastation. So I used to sneak down to my friend's house and we'd backcomb each other's hair just before we'd go to Wesley, was this teenage disco just over there in Donnybrook. And this was the time of Madonna's Like a Virgin, of Talking Heads. Stop Making Sense was the coolest film that you could watch. It was a little above me, I have to say. And then, of course, Kate Bush and Wuthering Heights. It was just glorious times.
Let's hear a little bit of The Cure and Boys Don't Cry. Boys Don't Cry. Now, we asked you for favourite bands, favourite artists, and you've picked Lisa O'Neill. Why have you gone for Lisa O'Neill?
Lisa O'Neill is incredible live. She kind of transforms from this gorgeous wee woman, as she'd say herself, to this massive powerhouse when she comes on stage. She says, hi, everybody, and then she stomps her feet, strums that guitar, and becomes this kind of powerhouse, like a Margaret Barry from back in the days.
And sorry, who's Margaret Barry?
Margaret Barry was a travelling singer. She did all this fiddling and diddling. I think her famous recording was as she moved through the fair. She lived up, eventually lived up north in Down or something like that outside Banbridge. Incredible legacy of folk music, I suppose. I think she was probably at her height in the 60s and the 70s around that folk revival. And Lisa is the embodiment of this, except, you know, she writes her own tunes. And she has a song called Around the Wren. And I'm, as you said, just about to make this live exhibition. And I'm really musing on this idea of the wrens of the Curragh. So these women who lived in furze bushes, inside furze bushes.
When?
This is around the mid-19th century. So somewhere around the famine time up until the turn of the century there. Incredible stories of these kind of lost women and girls who we don't know what happened, that they became homeless or became dislocated from their family. One could guess it's around the famine time and what was happening there. And they kind of came together. Their job was as prostitutes serving the British Army. But really interestingly, they lived in this kind of feminist ideal of a matriarchal society where they minded each other and supported each other in lots of different ways. But they were called wrens. Wrens because they lived within these furze bushes. And what I found out is that any women who were othered, living on the street, maybe outside of society, around the country, seemed to have been called wrens. And, you know, when you're cooking up a new piece of work, it's almost like baking a cake. You've different ingredients in terms of the research of this. And, of course, we also think of the Wren Boys, these really exciting trickster wildness that happens on Stephen's Day. And the poem, the Wren, the king of the birds, on Stephen's Day was caught in the furze. Her clothes were all torn, her shoes were all worn. Up the kettle and down the pan and give us a penny to bury the Wren. So I still am, I'm in the studio just musing. What is We think the straightforward story is about this little bird, but actually her clothes were all torn and her shoes were all worn. And the fact that we used to call these othered women wrens is really exciting intellectually to play with.
Let's hear a bit of Lisa O'Neill singing the Wren, the Wren.
The Wren, the Wren, the king of all birds, and Stephen's Day was caught in the furze. Although he was little, his honour was great. Jump up, me lads, and give us a treat. He said he was going to kill and all. I met the Wren upon the wall. Opened me wattle and knocked him down and brought him into Carrick Town. Drolling, drolling, where's your nest? Is in the bush that I love best. In the bush, the holly tree, where all the boys do follow me. Oh, put the kettle and down with the pan and give us a penny to bury the Wren. We follow the Wren 3 miles or more, 3 miles or more, 3 miles or more. Follow the Wren 3 miles or more at 6 o'clock in the morning. I have a little box under me arm, under me arm, under me arm.
Okay, Lisa O'Neill. And that actually brings me nicely to best gigs you're ever at, because I think that's sort of partly of the sort of tradition that Damien Dempsey has tapped into as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there's nothing like a demo gig. There's just nothing in the world like a demo gig.
It seems like a religious experience for many of his fans.
It's incredible. I mean, it's special for me because my brother introduced myself and my sister to him many, many years ago. And when we go, the three of us, to the gigs, and we're literally, your arms are in the air and you're punching. It's a big sing-along, almost like a Christy Moore sing-along. He doesn't like them singing. Sure he doesn't. Anyway, we all sing along to Christy Moore songs. But to Damo, he really encourages it. He hands us the microphone. You know, he puts it out towards the crowd. And so in terms of liveness, and I'm a live artist, I just love this excitement of togetherness, everyone experiencing this thing. And he, no more than Lisa O'Neill, he is a master in the live event.
Let's hear a little bit of Damien Dempsey singing The Apple of My Eye at a concert in London. Dempsey's singing The Apple of My Eye. I want to ask you about favourite movies, actor, director. You've gone for one, kneecap. And there's a particular reason for this, given you're also a sign language interpreter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a parallel career. It has been a parallel career I'm so lucky to have it. And I've interpreted many amazing things. I'm mostly a theatre interpreter. But the kneecap film just blew my head. Because, of course, we start off, first of all, with language rights. And as somebody who was brought up in the minority language of sign language, which was only recognised in 2017. So when I was growing up, it was a hidden language. We didn't sign outside on the street. It was a little shameful.
Shameful?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why and how?
Oh, look at those monkeys. Look at those family waving their hands in the air. Look at the, they're like monkeys. It is different landscape now to sign, where I think actually everybody really appreciates and loves sign language and sees it for the beautiful language that it is. But I'm telling you, in the 70s, when we still institutionalized deaf children, we still institutionalized so many people. I mean, Ireland was a radically different place. 70s in the 80s. And it's incredible to see the blossoming of, you know, my parents, my cousins, my aunts and uncle, all of these deaf people who use, my friends who use sign language as their language of need. You know, I use sign language as my language of choice when I want to. But for deaf people, it's a language of need. And it's such a beautiful language.
So then bring us to the kneecap reason.
But kneecap, yeah. So I went off on a
That's fine. I brought you down
back
there.
Down off my soapbox here. But the kneecap story, of course, is about the language rights at its core in terms of the Irish language. I'm living in Belfast at the moment. And of course, they banned Irish. They wouldn't fund Irish schools or the speaking of Irish up until 2022. Like, it's crazy on this island to think about this. So straight away they had me about the language rights. And then we see, I think he's called DJ Provy, coming in as the teacher and as the translator, interpreter into the police station when Mo Cara is arrested.
And is being interrogated.
Yeah.
Let's just hear that and we'll talk more about after it.
What's this mean?
I got up this morning, at the end of the day, before I leave the bed, a spliff and a cup of tea. Now I have a big night ahead of me because of yesterday. I spent all my DLA on MDMA.
Abrelay just goes in his far nearly.
Filiate?
Scribble all. Because Bavralum to stop egg chanting like.
Oh, what are you to look for any reference to an Arlo? Oh, car lion.
Sinan de Trani, K. can't even have like I will too.
What's he saying?
Cruhinish it to he?
What?
Because I should give you orza cruhi go, but not what bear logged. I should take her to August cruhia orza August Hannah he in.
Sure, Shannon to Miss Ranaga.
Hi. He says he doesn't have to prove that Irish is his only language because absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's just a basic principle of modern justice.
He said that.
Yeah. And he says that furthermore, and notwithstanding the aforementioned, he sees no reason to prove that he cannot speak English because he's here asserting his right to speak Irish.
A very cheeky interpreter there, but really great fun, you know, in terms of the story and what happens in there. Of course, as a sign language interpreter, I would never put words in somebody's mouth.
Okay, give us favourite books and authors. You've got a collection of Irish female writers who you love.
Oh, listen, Sinead Gleeson's Hagstone. I think it's from last year. I think it was published last year. I absolutely loved it. It's about a performance artist, of course. So I see a lot of realism and recognition, but a really incredible story that brings us to the edge, literally, of an island and a cliff and all of those glorious things that are happening within there. Yeah.
And you also have Anne Enright. Anything by Anne Enright?
No, absolutely anything. Of course, her recent book, The Wren, The Wren, I absolutely loved. But The Gathering, all of her books, they're so crisp and clean. But I'm really, I'm saving Elaine Feeney's brand new book for my when
she
I
will be with us
exhibition.
In the coming days here on the programme talking
brilliant.
About it.
Yeah, I've heard her talking about it and I'm just dying to read it. I absolutely loved How to Build a Boat. That's the correct title for it. So I'm really, really looking forward to Let Me Go Mad in my own.
Okay, I'm looking at the time. Unfortunately, we're getting short on time. So television, tell us what you grew up with and you loved and still remember.
Are you joking? Pride and Prejudice. The BBC only with Colin Farrell. And
Colin Firth, surely, not Colin Farrell.
Where am I? Colin Firth coming out of the lake. Full stop. Jennifer L. is fabulous as well as Elizabeth Bennet. But that even the music, just if I need a little bit of couch time, you know, a duvet day, BBC's Pride and Prejudice from the 1990s.
But you've really gone native in Belfast, haven't you, with your modern day choices, because it's things like The Fall, Line of Duty and Blue Lights.
Absolutely. Like, The Fall was incredible, made before I moved to Belfast. But I can't wait for the next Blue Lights. I mean, also, my husband runs the Lyric Theatre up there in Belfast. So also we watch these things and we know half of the people in them because they're actors on the ground in Belfast. It's also great fun. But I think Blue Lights is incredible. And The Line of Duty, come on, he didn't come up the lag in a bubble. All of that great crack that we had with Adrian Dunbar.
Okay, and I believe you're looking forward to a new documentary by Gary Keane as well, A Quiet Love.
I think this is going to be really, really special. I'm a great fan of Gary Keane's work, but he has followed three deaf couples and their experiences and love. And I know one of the couples really well, John Carberry and Agnes Carberry, who live in Belfast. She was Protestant. He was Catholic. She was from East Belfast. He was from West Belfast. And the story of their love, I know it from them telling us and the community knowing about it. But I'd say Gary will make a beautiful, beautiful job on this.
To finish, a cultural buried treasure, you have gone for the Sheila na Gcaig sculptures.
Are incredible. Sheila na Gcaig stone sculptures. They're dotted all over the country. But the National Gallery have a collection of maybe 9 or 10 of them, the last time I counted. And some of them are on display. I think one or two are on display upstairs amid our beautiful gold torques. These are stone carvings of hags, of women with their legs akimbo, their hands inside their pudneys, holding it open. Sometimes their tongues are hanging out. So it's in the, these are in the tradition of the European great bitch, in the greatest sense of this female power. They're incredible stone sculptures. I urge everybody to apply, especially to the National Gallery, to go down to their stores and see them.
Amanda Coogan, it has been great meeting you. Hope everything goes well for you with the Cork Midsummer Festival and your performance piece at the Cork Centre for Architectural Education from the 14th of June. Thank you very much for being with us. Big thank you to my entire production team. We'll be back tomorrow at 4:30. Until then, from me, Matt Cooper, have a very good evening.
The Last Word on Today FM.